My congratulations to you people for helping us keep that dream alive of traveling in space. It's the only dream that I pay attention to anymore, is making sure we don't lose focus on the fact that this country, this world needs to continue to explore space for peaceful purposes. And I emphasize peaceful purposes because I never want to hear of an astronaut or a cosmonaut going into space with a sidearm. Let's hope that never happens in our lifetime. I want to give you a quick look at the early days of space travel. I'm not going to go into the shuttle program. This is basically Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. I dealt with the Mercury astronauts, which was an interesting experience, I might add, and I'll talk about that a little bit. And we picked those guys in those early years, Shepard and Shirov and Glenn. We found out real quickly that they knew nothing about rocks. Geology was something that they didn't think was actually to be concerned about because they were fighter pilots and test pilots. So what did we do? We took them out in the desert in New Mexico, and we basically gave them geology 101. And we're out there in the middle of the desert, and in those days, NASA never did anything small. We had generators running in the background. We had portable dormitories, had suit technicians, the doctors, geologists, and in the middle of about 50 people in this circle were these two guys, suited up, completely suited up in moonwalking suits. We've been out there, and the second day, a tribe of Indians arrived. And the guy in charge of the test program said, "Buckby, today you are in charge of Indians." So I go out to engage and meet the young buck who's leading the tribe. Turns out that we are on the edge of their reservation, and he wanted to know what I was doing. And I said, "We are from the government," which was a mistake. Then I said, "We're also from NASA, and we're here, and we're training these two men to go to the moon," and pointed to the moon. He looked at me, and he looked at the astronauts and said, "We'd like to return tomorrow and bring our chief to meet the astronauts. Is that possible?" I said, "Yes, sir." Sure enough, the next morning, tribe's returning. Riding in front is a gentleman with full battle dress, carried a spear, war paint, obviously the chief. They dismount. We introduce ourselves, take the chief over, introduce him to the two astronauts, have some pictures taken, and we're about to have them break up, and we were going to go about our testing. And just as we're about to break up, the chief reaches into a pouch and pulls out a cassette and hands it to one of the astronauts and said, through the young buck who was translating, "Would you take this to the moon?" And the astronaut said, "Yes, sir, we'd be happy to do that." They rode off into the sunset. We continued training. About 2 days later, we're back in Houston going through debriefing and unpacking, and somebody said, "Where's the chief's message?" We looked around, found it, found the machine, put it in, could not understand one word. It was in Navajo. So we sent the messenger out to find someone who could understand and speak Navajo, found the guy. He came in. He put the tape recorder in the machine, played it, and he burst out laughing. And we said, "What did the Indian chief say?" He said, "Dear moon people, beware of white man. That SOB will steal your land." True story. This is Shepard on the left and Shirov on the right. I'm in the middle. And we basically worked together from the day they became astronauts until they retired. The great thing about those two guys, they helped me create Space Camp. They believed in it, they contributed to it, and they made it work, both in Huntsville and in Florida. So I had a lot of contact with them over the years, and we actually invented the thing, the Real Space Cowboys, and they loved it. We used it frequently, and today I still have some buddies who are in that category, but those are the two guys that really got us off the ground. We wrote this book called The Real Space Cowboys, which most of it is true. My part certainly is true. I can't always be sure about what their stories are, but it was basically the story of the early days of the Mercury astronauts. And in my career, I basically touched every one of those missions you see on that chart. There were actually 32 missions about 44 astronauts from 1961 through 1975. I was either involved at the Cape in Houston, Huntsville, either in the press area or welcoming them as they came back from their mission at our museum. So I had an interesting experience with Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts. Space Camp, great idea. Whose was it? Wasn't mine. Wernher von Braun came up with the idea. We've got to give the young people of this country a glimpse of their future. And we want their future to be the exploration of space. And he was the guy who came up with the idea. I happened to be the guy on the ground who made it happen. So it was a fun program, and we're still excited about it. These are the guys I work with today. We lost those first three on the left, but we got Stafford, Duke, Schmidt, and Cernan. Those four guys participated, of course, in Apollo. Three of them are moonwalkers. And they are now the real space cowboys and the guys that we go around the world talking about the program. I don't have to remind you folks that this was a shocker this day. The Russians launched Sputnik, and that got a lot of attention all over the world. We thought that the Russians were really good tractor drivers, great farmers, but had no technology capabilities. Turns out we were badly mistaken, but it did engage our people. And I remember my professors telling me, you guys need to start studying engineering. This country is going to need engineers. And it did. It caused a whole development in the education process. We finally got that old Redstone that we had developed in Huntsville, Alabama as a missile. And we took the warhead off and put a satellite on. And that's Explorer 1. And that the day that was launched was the day that the space race began between Russia and the U.S. Well, guess what? 1959, President Eisenhower decided we need astronauts. Who do you think volunteered? Three Air Force, three Navy, and one Marine. Why? Because they wanted to go higher, faster, and farther. And to do that, you had to be an astronaut. Guys and gals, you are looking at the most interesting seven people I've ever encountered. They have a lot of swagger. You're talking egos beyond imagination. And if you ask them who's the best, every one of them will tell you, I'm the best. And in fact, when their boss brought them in for their first meeting, he asked them to write down the name of the first astronaut in this family who should fly in space. Who do you think they wrote down? Every one of them wrote their name, their own name down. So you get an idea of the kind of people that we're dealing with. They are looking for a challenge, and the best opportunity was to fly on a NASA rocket. We took them to Washington, and I think this was the first time they ever had a coat and tie on in their life, and the press went crazy. They're standing up on the tables. They're leaning over chairs. They're crawling around on the floor, and they're asking questions like, do you think you'll get back from space alive? That seemed to be the most interesting question of all from the press, because they thought these guys were just going to jump on these rockets, we would blow them up, and they would, of course, pass away. So that was a coming out party for the Mercury family. We worked on this forever. We wanted a family portrait, and they hated these pictures because, as Shepard said, in those days we only had one suit, and we took turns wearing that suit. Well, there's one good suit, and the one on the left, that's Wally. He owned the suit, so he had the best suit on. The other six are rejects. The zippers don't work. The hoses are falling down in the back. In fact, John and the two guys in the middle have got combat boots on that we sprayed with silver paint. Would you believe this picture made the cover of Life magazine, Look magazine, and all over Europe magazine covers? It turned out to be, you know, the family portrait of the Mercury 7. In fact, it's on the cover of my book, and it shows up all the time. So when you see that, you'll appreciate the effort that went in to make that picture, because they hated that picture to this day, and especially after the movie The Right Stuff came out, because they used the same picture, and that even made them more disbelieving of what took place in the movie Right Stuff. The amount of testing these guys went through to be qualified at the Lovelace Clinic, and by the way, they hated that place. Are you familiar with the Lovelace Clinic? That was the place where they went in. They were not only examined. As John Glenn said, they found openings in my body that I did not know I had. So right here, this doctor, and they called him the doctors, they called him the medical cult. That medical cult doctor has just poured hot water in one of John's ears. He's now pouring cold water in the other ear for the purpose of seeing whether that has any effect on his eyeball movement. Now, we haven't figured out what that has to do with space travel, but that's the type of test these poor guys went through in those early years. And for some reason, they loved to vibrate their bodies. And they went through all sorts of crazy vibrations, being dropped from high altitudes and made on things like special harness, ejection seats, again, trying to determine whether they could survive. So they went through that. And by the way, after the Mercury astronauts were tested, we never sent another astronaut to the Lovelace Clinic, because these seven guys said, you're not going to expect other people to go through this like what we've done through. So that was stopped. This was a very important machine in those days. They called it the wheel. It's really a centrifuge. You all know what a centrifuge is. Well, these fellas went through this machine on a monthly basis. You know how many G's they took? 16, ladies and gentlemen. That's 16 times your normal weight. Not necessarily because they would get it in a rocket ride, but if they had to hit the chicken switch, which was the ejection system, for a brief moment coming off that rocket with an escape tower, they would get about 16 G's. So they had to be acclimated to that, and that's why that machine was used. They went through all sorts of training in the desert, jungle. They ended up very soon in Huntsville, Alabama. Why do you think they came there? You see that guy on the right? That's Wernher von Braun. They came to meet the Rocket Man, because the Rocket Man was designing their ride to the moon. And that it was a custom for a fighter pilot and a test pilot to become very knowledgeable of the guy who was developing their aircraft. They wanted to get close to that person. And so they met von Braun. They loved his attitude. They loved the challenge that he accepted. And once they talked to him, they realized, hey, we're going to go to the moon. This guy's really going to make it happen. So it was a confidence builder to hang out with people like that. And we tested those rockets in those days. We still do. Ground testing is what we did. We didn't launch anything, but we tested the vehicle on the ground. And before we shipped to the Cape, it always went through a ground test. Shepard came in, watched several of those, and he came up to von Braun after one of them and said, I want to stand up on the tower next to that spacecraft while you're firing the engine. And Wernher said, well, Alan, why are you going to do that? He said, I want to see if I can read the instruments and reach the control handle. Test pilot attitude, mentality was flowing strongly. Von Braun said, no, it's too dangerous. I'm not going to let you do that. Guess what? He got two engineers to volunteer to do that. And sure enough, they stood up next to the spacecraft, looked in the window while it was being fired, and they could see the instruments and reach the control panel. So, again, it was a shocking surprise to the astronauts that they were actually not going to control the Mercury machine, that they were actually going to ride. And so there was always a fight between the engineers and the astronauts about the amount of control that they had, especially in the early days. Engineers said, we don't trust those astronauts. We want that machine to go based on the way we operate. It eventually changed, but in the early days, the astronauts had very little control of the spacecraft. Monkeys, primates, chimpanzees. I tell you what, I've never heard an astronaut have any kind words for a monkey. And the reason for that, these monkeys got all the rides in the early years. They showed up on the cover of Life magazine. They were the test articles, and the doctors loved them. Because, you know, the monkey would go away and fly, come back, they put him in the cage and have to forget about it. So it was an interesting experience to watch the astronauts see these monkeys get all the attention. And one day, just before Shepard was to fly, they had just flown Enos on this flight. And the doctors were so excited about Enos's accomplishments, so they were getting ready to have a press conference. So Shepard said, Shira and Shepard were talking about it, and Shira said, Shepard, you're going to be doing this next. So you need to go over, and we need to stand in the press room and hear what goes on, find out what kind of questions they ask. And sure enough, they put on their Bebop glasses, fighter pilot glasses, and a cap, went over and stood back in the back of the press room. And they brought Enos out, and the doctors read off all the accomplishments that Enos had made on that flight. And just as they turn on the lights and the cameras, Enos reaches down and rips off his diaper and exposes himself. And Shiraz says to Shepard, "You're next." This was not a good day at the Cape. I did not see this one, but... In fact, they let the tape run just as if the machine had functioned properly, and they decided it was okay, to continue. So I don't know if you can hold that. Like, allow that thing. So anyway, what happened was they delayed. Check this out. Marvin Brown made that decision, and you know what happened.
It just slipped back on again. Yeah.
Okay. Can you stick it on there? Gagarin became the first American, first human, the blind space. Shepard will never, never forget on Brown for making that decision. But it was the right thing at the right time. So, it didn't take long. May 5, 1961, we got Shepard ready. And he climbed in a spacecraft. And it was my first rocket or missile ever to see flown, May 5, 1961. And we had liftoff. And ladies and gentlemen, that was the beginning of manned space flight for the United States of America. And it continues today to be our business in flying humans in space. With only that short flight around, this young president, Jack Kennedy, became excited about the space program. And he called him to the White House.
Therefore, I want to again express my congratulations to Alan Shepard. We're very proud of him. And I speak on behalf of the Vice President, who is Chairman of our Space Council and who bears great responsibilities in this field, the members of the House and Senate Space Committee who are with us today, and this decoration, which has gone from the ground up here.
That was a big day for the families, for Kennedy and all of us. And with only 15 minutes of space flight under our belt, this young president committed the country to this.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept.
Thank you.
One we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
So, with only 15 minutes of flight under our belt, not even make Earth orbit, that young president committed us to go to the moon within this decade and kick the Russians' butt in space. We had a mission. The astronauts certainly had some flights ahead for them. So we were in business. It was serious competition. We got John Glenn ready, as you know, in February of 62. And he climbed aboard, and guess what was one of the first things he acknowledged from Earth orbit? Can you see that little blip? That's Perth. Perth was the first city to be acknowledged on planet Earth from our astronaut corps. And that was a big deal because we were so dependent upon your tracking stations in those early flights. John retired. We were told, John's a national treasure. We'll never take another chance flying him in space. So he retired. He left the space program because basically no chance for him to fly Gemini or Apollo. That's a true story. He was basically determined to be a treasure for the country. So we will not see him fly again. So he went away, became a U.S. senator, did a great job. But all of a sudden, he convinced a president by the name of Bill Clinton to fly on the shuttle at the age of 77. And he did. And it was a very successful flight. And look at these pictures that he got on that flight some many years ago of that same area that we looked at earlier, known as Perth. John is our last member of the Mercury family living today. He's 96 years old. He's doing fine. And so he was a real contributor along with all those other Mercury guys in the early years. We went into the Gemini program, probably a program totally forgotten. But let me tell you, folks, it was a major training exercise for those astronauts. We did our first walk in space with Ed White. We did a number of multi-flights, and here's one I'll share with you of Wally Schirra.
Sitting atop 100 tons of explosive liquid fuel, Wally Schirra proves unbelievably cool when his Titan rocket fails.
That's Wally. We're just sitting here breathing. That's so typical of Schirra. You know why he didn't eject? Because he had flown before on a Mercury, and he felt it in the seat of his pants. And although all the instruments went off in that spacecraft saying it had lifted off, it hadn't. And that's why he didn't hit the chicken switch and eject, because he knew that machine hadn't launched. 3 days later, launched it, went well. So now we've got our first to have two spacecraft in orbit at the same time. These fighter pilots love this machine because they had a window. You're looking out the window on the right seat. They're riding in it, looking out like they're in a cockpit. They got a joystick, ejection system, and they're flying side by side, feet apart, at 17,500 miles an hour in Earth orbit. And they loved it. This is Frank Borman over here on the other spacecraft with Jim Lovell. They went up for 14 days. And, of course, Wally, once he got up there, he reminded them that the Army was going to get beaten in football. The Army was going to get beaten in football by the Navy. So he put a little sign up in the window saying, "Beat Army." And sure enough, the Navy did beat the Army in football that weekend. Now, that was typical of Schirra. He liked to do jokes and gotchas, and he did a lot of those. This is a shot of them first in Houston. They have been made honorary Texans. They've also been made honorary Texas Rangers. And I asked Wally, I said, "What are you saying to Alan Shepard with that Texas Ranger certificate in your hand?" He's saying, "Guess what, Shepard? No more speeding tickets in Texas." And ladies and gentlemen, I can assure you they used those Texas Ranger certificates when they drove those Corvettes flat out 90-100 miles an hour on those flat Texas roads, because they were car crazy, except for John. John drove a Hudson. He drove a Hudson. Everybody else drove Corvettes, and they definitely tested their ability to do things in Texas with Corvettes. This was probably the biggest day in Wonderman Brown's life. President Jack Kennedy came to Huntsville to see Von Braun, to meet him, to find out, can we really go to the moon and do it with these rockets that you're building? He had heard about Von Braun. He had letters from Von Braun. He knew who he was, but he had never met him. So he came specifically to meet him and to see what we were doing. And we showed him what we were doing. We were building these big rockets in Huntsville before anybody else ever saw them. We built them, and we ground-tested them there before they were shipped to the Cape for launch. So that's what Von Braun was doing, was developing and testing the big Saturn V moon rocket. And unbeknownst to us, at that very time, the Russians were building this thing called the N1. And ladies and gentlemen, that thing had 30 engines on the first stage, 400 feet long, four stages, a monster rocket. And we, at my level, certainly had no knowledge of this, but we found out later that the Russians were certainly involved in that program. This machine was launched unmanned three times and failed. And, well, you say four. Alexei Leonov does not agree with you. So I'm sorry. That's what I said. Same thing. Alexei said that fourth one never got off. So anyway, that was something we were not aware of, but it basically ended up killing their program. We didn't know it at the time. And the other thing that Alexei told me, the Russian people did not realize that we were in a race with them in space. They had no idea that there was true competition going on, because the information flowing to the Russian people was fixed, or it was delayed, or it never happened. And that was news to us. We, again, were in the ground test firing. You see that? You can't see that big tank vertical? That's a Saturn V booster. That baby is tanked up, loaded, and it would run for 2.5 minutes. And I watched 40 of those test firings about 2,000 feet away. And ladies and gentlemen, it beats a launch by far. You feel the heat come up your pants leg. The vibration hits your diaphragm. You look at your buddy, his skin's pulled back like he's watching a nuclear blast. It is the ultimate experience of watching rocketry. Here we go. That's 2.5 minutes burning time. 160 million horsepower. That's like a string of automobiles all the way across the United States of America, all the way from Seattle to New York, with accelerators all the way to the floor. The most powerful machine we ever built that we could control. And that baby never failed. That Saturn rocket never failed, unmanned or manned, in all the flights that we made. And we put 27 astronauts around the moon, and 12 of them landed on the moon. So we were very proud of that, and that's what Kennedy had a chance to see. The baby, he didn't see the big Saturn V, he saw the baby fly, the fire, and he was very impressed. Here we are. We've flown 16 times, not a scratch on an astronaut. Apollo 1, running a ground test. We have a short develop. We have a fire, and we kill 3 astronauts. Ladies and gentlemen, it brought NASA to its knees. Many of us thought the program was over. We would never make it to the moon. We would go on and do something else. That was a wake-up call. But men like Von Braun and others in the NASA family, Divas from the Cape, came together and said, we can fix this. And they did. 18 months later, we flew Wally and his crew on Apollo 7. And Wally was the first guy, and he never let us forget it, by the way, to fly Apollo successful. Now, Wally is the only astronaut to fly Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. And it was a very successful mission. It gave everybody confidence in the spacecraft, and, of course, the Saturn worked well. You couldn't go anywhere in those days and not see signs around laying on people's desks, late to bed, early to rise, work like hell, and advertise. You go down the hall to a water fountain, you'd hear 3 words: man, moon, decade. There was a passion about what we did. The deal was, today's work must be done today. You don't leave work until you finish today's work. Get a note from Von Braun. He would say, remember, we're on the critical path. And what that meant was, our team was flying with that crew scheduled to go on the next mission. So we remembered the critical path was a part of our mission. And so it was a time when there was a lot of passion for what we did. And you did your work before you went home. We got that big Saturn V to fly in 68, December 68. You'll remember that was an orbit around the moon. This was the first time that we'd ever flown a human out of Earth orbit. And that's when all your tracking stations truly began to kick in. And we became comfortable with being able to communicate. For example, we could test Alan Shepard's body temperature while he was walking on the moon. We monitored his heart. We knew exactly what the condition of all those guys were, 240,000 miles away. And this was in the late 60s. A lot of that technology burst quickly in our country. But you guys did a great job with the tracking business. This is the crew: Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. Armstrong still gets the vote, probably the best astronaut, I have to be very careful when I say this around my buddies from the Mercury and Gemini era, but I'm telling you, that guy had it, and he was the perfect one to be selected to be the first. And he was so easy to work with, but he was focused on the mission. And that's why I think they picked him, and he did a wonderful job. Here we go. July 69.
Okay, engine stop. We copy you down, Eagle.
That's Charlie Duke in Mission Control. He wrote those words himself, by the way. And this little picture, you guys made this happen. We would have never seen this live if it hadn't been for Tracking Station of Australia. That's a very, very historic picture in my mind. He's holding on to that ladder one more time. And he wrote those words too, by the way. We were on the moon, 1969, and we did kick the Russians' butt in space. Those guys wore a ton of equipment. Astronaut equipment weighed about 370 Earth pounds, but on the moon, 1/6. So they were able to really maneuver around a lot easier than you would expect. They had a backpack on, air conditioning, heating system, communications, a visor for taking care of their eyes, checklist. Guess what? Astronauts do not read checklist. So what do? We begin to add things to the checklist. A little piece from Playboy magazine in the middle of the checklist. Guess what? The astronauts begin to read the checklist after that. So we knew if we wanted to get their attention, we would put something unusual in the checklist, and we'd find out that they most of the time would read them. The other thing that we had, of course, they wore the Omega watch, which is the only watch that's been to the moon, the Swiss Speedmaster. And that watch, by the way, came off the shelf, tested by NASA, and they put it right on the astronaut without one change in that watch. And that thing flew many, many missions without any changes by the manufacturer. Amazing that it was built in such a manner that it would survive the hostile environment on the moon. The other thing that they had inside their helmet, you know, they were on the moon about 3 hours, and they needed something, you know, certainly something to drink. So they came up with this Tang drink. General Foods invented it, and they claimed it was the drink of the astronauts. Well, that's not true of all the astronauts, I can assure you. About the third mission, a doctor in Houston decided to add potassium to the Tang. And when you consume Tang with potassium, you get gas. And ladies and gentlemen, I had the opportunity, along with several other rather frightened public affairs people, listening to two ex-fighter pilots describe their gas problem on the moon. I heard words and terms I have never heard in my life. It went on for 12 minutes, and we thought it was going out to the world because it sounded, it was coming in Mission Control, being bumped over to the press room. Thank goodness it was only being heard in the press room and, of course, Mission Control. The Mission Control people went crazy, of course, but it got worse. You know, they started talking about, well, John Young was from Florida. He says, I'll never drink another glass of orange juice. And they heard it. People down in Florida heard it. And the governor finally found out about it. He got on TV and said it was not a product from the state of Florida. It was an imitation drink. So anyway, it went on, and finally we got word up to him, it's a hot mic, guys. Please turn it off. And they did. But we had to do something at the splashdown party. So what did we do? We invented a new product, a prune tank. And that became another amusing thing on that particular mission. The last three flights had a moon buggy, that machine you see on the right. We call it the moon jalopy. Great, great vehicle. And those astronauts loved it. You know, you can imagine, here we are, Corvette drivers. Well, now they get to drive a vehicle on the moon's surface. And they had a ball. And here is a typical drive by John Young, and Charlie Duke is running the commentary. Here we go.
Man, you're really bouncing.
10 miles an hour, top speed. Rough terrain up there.
He's got about two wheels on the ground. He's pretty sharp.
That's the commander speaking, of course. He's in charge. But they had a ball. The dust was everywhere, by the way, all over their clothes, all over the seats. Never could conquer the dust. And that was the, we didn't know what was going on in the press room. Nobody told us they were going to do this. So they, you know, sort of did it themselves. But it worked out fine. They came home safely. But you come up and you'll see the dust coming off those wheels. Those are wire wheels. Yep. Successful Indy 500 on the moon. I talked to Shepard a lot about the moon flight because he was the guy I spent the most time with, had been there. And, you know, he had been through Mercury and he'd watched all the other guys fly and so forth. And I asked him, I said, what do you remember about? And, you know, he told me, he says, it's difficult because it went so fast. And all of them say that we were so busy, you know, running down the list and talking to mission control. It's hard to remember the experience. But he said, there's one event that I remember. He said, I got up the second morning and looked out the window in that spacecraft and saw the Earth, and I could cover it up with my thumb. I could cover up Earth with my thumb. And he said, I realized I was 240,000 miles away from my planet. And he said, that was a memorable event for me. And he said, a lot of other guys had a similar experience, realizing how far they were away. I have to show you this clip, and this was another one of those deals where we had no idea that this was going to happen, and it was somewhat difficult to explain for the press because we told them they were up there working very hard, studying things, scientific, and this is CERN. Jack Schmidt. One-sixth gravity. Can you imagine what Sherrod and Shepard said when they heard one of their colleagues is skipping on the moon? That made some interesting comments at the splashdown party, I can assure you that. CERN had a problem getting rid of that comment for a long time. This was the critical part of that mission, and we had never seen a liftoff live until Apollo 17. What they did, they parked the moon buggy about 200 yards away from the spacecraft. And on that moon buggy was a television camera. And a guy in mission control could control it with a joystick. And he basically lined the camera up, and we got to see liftoff from the moon, Apollo 17, the first time. I'm telling you guys and gals, that was a wake-up call, because you got to understand, we didn't have a backup rocket the Cape to go get these guys. There was no capability of in lunar orbit to come down and pick them up and take them home. They were totally dependent on that little rocket engine and that lunar module, upper stage. And it had worked previously, and this was the last mission. Excuse me. So as we watched that, I remembered that we had prepared three news releases. One, all three astronauts returned safely. Second release, one astronaut returned safely, two are lost. Third release, all three astronauts are lost, either on the moon or in lunar orbit. And those briefings, those three briefings were taken all the way to the White House. The president was prepared, administrator of NASA, Deke Slayton in charge of the astronaut corps were prepared to deal with a catastrophe like that. But, you know, we put 27 astronauts up there. 12 of them walked on the moon. And we were very fortunate, ladies and gentlemen, not to have a serious problem in lunar orbit. But that was a big deal, that particular flight. Here we go. It goes straight up like an elevator. They're standing up in that spacecraft. They only get about a G and a half on liftoff, and that puts them in lunar orbit. They dock with their mothership. The third guy's up there, and they come home. And that was great to see. But it was a real experience for us to watch that live. And so the last man to walk on the moon was Gene CERN in 1972. We haven't been back. Nobody's gone out of Earth orbit since then. And we were very fortunate to bring all those fellows home. No, these are not homeless people, I promise you. This is six of America's heroes. And you got to admit, their dress code is picked up. This is 1965 at Disney World. And I think Wally owned that checkered suit, and he shared the jacket with John. So I think they got a little extra wear out of it that weekend. But he has pork. Scott Carpenter's got pork chop. You remember pork chop haircut? He's got one and wearing those lavender trousers. So I had to throw that picture in for you because it does show that they were changing a bit. I have to apologize to you on behalf of NASA for using your country as a drop zone for used and unneeded space hardware. Because when we decided to drop Skylab, I was told it was going to land in the ocean. And probably you were told it was going to land in the ocean. Well, it didn't. A lot of the components ended up in your country. And guess what? I ended up at my museum receiving one of them. That's an oxygen vessel that was wrapped in fiberglass. And that's why it survived reentry. You'll see on one end, it's kind of black. That's the end it reentered in. And it survived. And I understand there's a couple more sizable pieces somewhere in Australia that came down from Skylab. So I apologize to you on behalf of NASA for dumping our junk on your country. These are the guys that I worked with, and I look after them as the real heroes of the space program in the USA. They were the first. They were the bold. They were the brave that stepped up and said, we're going to take our flag into space. And they were successful at doing that. And Shepard, again, shared with me a story. The night before he was to fly, he couldn't sleep. Can you imagine? Guy's just going to climb on a rocket the next morning, fly 240,000 miles away. So he went out to the rocket launch pad in a pickup truck. In those days, that was pretty common. And he got out of the pickup and was going to go up to the top of the rocket to spacecraft level, about halfway up. And by the way, that rocket's being fueled. And it's bumping and humming, and that fuel's expanding the metal. And it's making a lot of noise. He gets up there about halfway, and he sees a light on. Crawls out of the elevator, sticks his head in this compartment, and there's a guy in there working. So he crawls in the compartment, introduces himself, and finds out this is a technician. Interesting enough, this technician had worked on Shepard's Mercury 7 rocket in 1961. And here he was doing the same thing on Shepard's rocket about to go to the moon. So they talk about the weather, possible delays and aborts and so forth, and football, family, and all that. And finally, the technician says to Shepard, do you know how all these parts on this rocket work? 3 million parts. Shepard says, no, I've never met that guy. And this technician said, I haven't either. But I'm here tonight to make sure my part works tomorrow morning. And guys and gals, that's how we were successful at putting 12 American astronauts on the surface of the moon. They stood on the shoulders of 400,000 men and women in our country who get up every morning and said, I'm going to make my part work. And that's the legacy we leave with the younger generation today. And our country and your country, whatever you just choose to do, make sure your part works. You've been a great audience. Thank you very much. I got to tell you a quick story. When Tim came to pick me up at the ship, and we started getting in the car, I tried to get in the driver's compartment. That's how much I know about Australia. My wife said, "Oh my God, he's going to drive." Sorry about that.
Thanks very much again, Ed. That was great. We'd love to have you come back again sometime. Bring an astronaut or two with you.
I'd love to.
We'll certainly show them around and show you a good time. Take you up to Tindindilla, the primary trekking station.
Love to.
Show you Honeysuckle Creek that doesn't really exist anymore. Take you over to the parks. Do all those wonderful things that obviously need more time. So, once again, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Great host. I failed to mention my girlfriend. I'll have her stand up. Also, my first wife, and I should add my present wife. She's the one who really got me my job with the rocket science people, because she worked for one of the German rocket scientists, and that's how I met eventually met Von Braun was through my girlfriend at that time. Today is my present wife, Gail. Thank you. I don't know if we have any time for questions or not. If you do, anybody have questions? Yes, sir.
I've just got a quick story for you on Skylab.
Yeah.
I landed in the middle of the outback. It's on the road between here and Perth, and it's in the middle of nowhere. And there are tiny little road stops that are about 200 to 300 miles apart. So I pulled into one of these road stops on my drive where I knew that it was near where Skylab came down. This was a few years after it. And I said, isn't this where that American spaceship came down? And they said, yeah, that's right, mate. And I said, have you got any bits? And they said, well, we used to have some bits, but those Americans came out here and they came in and they took them all back.
That sounds like our people. But an Australian actually sent me that oxygen container. And I wish I had the name I could share with you. But he was kind enough to donate it to the museum. And
it really is the middle of nowhere.
Is it? Yeah. Were there more sizable pieces? I've been told there were.
I think they claimed off the record that one or two pieces might still be there, that the Americans didn't get all of them back.
There's actually a mini museum in the Brandon House in Caledonia.
Yeah, Caledonia, that was where I was, in Caledonia.
And they've just got a little memorial there on the actual bits and pieces that they've picked up through
well,
the desert.
You know, we were assured by the people in charge of this reentry that this thing would not even come close to a continent. I remember that clearly as being around the public affairs people, and they would say, oh, no problem, you know. And the next thing you know, it has impacted your country, and that really changed things in a hurry.
But it wasn't a controlled reentry, though.
No, it wasn't controlled.
So they just predicted it.
Yeah, but it wasn't like they could guide it. But
the gyro working again, and they were able to control the anti-mortar.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Came in yet, so you were at the time, but they didn't have
a
lot of control. But it's a very inexact science. You can't get it to be better than even in the last half of the final orbit. You really can't get any real good data on it at all.
Yeah. Right. You know, that was a monster piece of equipment.
Yeah.
We're talking 100 tons, you know.
Yeah,
plus ATM, airlock, all that other stuff hanging on the outside. It's a monster. We got a full scale in Huntsville.
Well,
and it's big.
They found a big chunk of it, and they hauled it to Perth. And around about that time, there was some world beauty contest being televised in Perth. Was it this world or this universe or something like that? And they hauled this thing up on the stage, and the stage collapsed.
Oh, PR people give you in trouble every time. Let's hear in the back.
Thanks, Ed, for your presentation.
Thank you. It was a chance of a lifetime for me. I was, 23 years old when I went to work there, and I had no idea that we were going to go to the moon, all that stuff. But you know, he was the kind of person that immediately you became confident of what he said he was going to do, and he was the guy who not only had the vision, but he technically was smart as hell. And he could go into a meeting and, you know, he could determine where the problem was. And he had a technique of giving that problem to be solved to three people. You know why? He'd have three choices on the solution. The knowledge that he had and what he was able to share with us really inspired my generation and enabled us to understand rocketry and the capability of humans flying on rockets. So he gave that to the Americans. He brought that with him. We didn't have it. You know, my guys were good engineers, but they didn't know anything about, you know, orbital mechanics or specific impulse of an engine. I mean, that was strange stuff. The Germans brought that to America, 150 of them, with 100 V-2 rockets complete. And we, thank goodness, got all that before the Russians got it. And that really enabled our country to go into the rockets, missiles. And the thing he does not get credit for, his team developed the anti-ballistic missile system that we're using today to protect our country. The anti-ballistic missile came out of Von Braun's mind at Redstone Arsenal. He and his team developed that, turned it over to the Army, and about that time is when they left the Army and became a part of NASA. Yes, sir. With who?
Robert Goddard.
No, he died before then. He visited with his wife.
Oh, okay.
And they had a good relationship. In fact, Von Braun supported the Goddard Library. But no, Robert had died. Yes, sir.
Ed, what's your current view about the future space missions, particularly the coming up in 2020 is the Europa mission, and NASA looking at also manned missions to Mars. Are you in favor
we got to have it. Oh, absolutely. You got to send the robots. You got to send the unmanned capable. But you see, we've been there 8 times. We got Curiosity up there now, digging and scratching right now. We're learning every minute of the day. We're learning something about Mars. We know more about Mars than any other country, any other team of people in the world. If we don't go to Mars and be first, I'm going to be extremely disappointed. I will not see it, but my kids will see it. My grandkids will see it. I'm probably talking 2030, 2035, and it's going to happen. Hopefully, we'll get there before the Chinese and the Russians. But that's what NASA needs to concentrate on. Let the private sector do the Earth orbital stuff, and the ferry port, sending astronauts up and back to the station. That should be turned over to the private sector. SpaceX and many other companies you'll hear more about, I think, in the future, will be that service group for NASA. But NASA needs to get this thing started, the Space Launch System vehicle, which is a Saturn V with big old strap-ons. We need to get that thing ready to go, but we have to have an advanced propulsion system. Do you realize we're still firing the same old rocket engines we did when we went the first time in Earth orbit?
The RS-2 is like 5 times more powerful than the second, apparently. The RS-2 rockets, which are testing at the moment.
Yeah.
They did a live test, and I think they're predicting like 70 tons they can lift.
But NASA's not spending enough money in research. We need a lot more research money to develop that new propulsion system. Now, you understand Von Braun had a plan to go to Mars in 1983. You aware of that? He made that briefing to Washington. I was on the airplane when he made that briefing. I carried his bag that day. He basically said, people, we can go to Mars by 1983 with 2 Saturn V, with nuclear upper stages. Scared the hell out of the people that he was talking to. Nuclear, that word, bad. Program died. We haven't done anything since, except we have done well with unmanned landings. That Curiosity was one heck of a machine. Landing as it did on Mars, you're talking about a small SUV we put up there, and it's working very well. Now, that's been totally overemphasized now. We were focused on the moon. We had a passion about that. Von Braun was in charge of the moon team. The Nazi thing never came up. And I was in the press. I should have got those questions. Didn't happen. But today, historians and curators are making that sound like that it occurred. Not true. We all knew that team had been through a situation in Petit Mundi. Knew very well. Arthur Rudolph was a good friend of mine. Well, they basically, and they caught him when he was sick. He had already left Huntsville. No lawyer. The Justice Department just screwed him good. Scared him to death. Said, we're going to take your retirement if you don't leave. And they did. He died, unfortunately. But that was so unfair. If we had not had that German team, folks, the Russians would be kicking our butt, and we probably would be speaking Russian in the United States of America today. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks. Just a quick one. You allude to a new space race getting to Mars, and we all hope that happens, but can you see it being a space race or a collaborative?
Oh, I'm all for cooperation. And I'd even, fly with the Chinese. Especially with all their money. But, I think we've got to think that way. I don't think it's anymore a single country trying to accomplish something like that.
We have a Russian gentleman here. It's all good.
I'm sure you can teach me some good Russian to say before I leave. But anyway, no, it's probably going to be an international crew. You know, and I would love to see six flags planted instead of one on Mars. I'd love to see it become an international mission. And hopefully that'll happen, because I tell you, it's going to be a sizable effort. You know, we may have good technology, but we're going to need more than what we have. We're certainly going to need more money. The other problem is, I don't know if we're ever going to get the leadership like we had back when Jack Kennedy was there that would make that commitment. That's the concern a lot of my friends have. Are we going to have a leader who will step up and say, let's go to Mars, let's do it within 20 years?
Well, I say it, but then nothing happens.
Pardon me?
A couple of times they've said it, they've committed to
it. Oh,
yeah,
but you know, they never put any resources behind it. It was just political talk, yeah. But Kennedy gave us 20. Listen, we never were told you can't have any more money in Apollo. The faucet was turned on and never turned off until we got there. We haven't had that happen in any program since, by the way. And I feel sorry for the NASA people, because they struggle to keep alive with what they do. They really do.
Yes, so on that same basis, right, it seems that the era of our launching into space, getting to the moon, right, was in a way a reaction to the Cold War.
Yeah,
okay?
That's true.
So back in 62, roughly, you had Gary Francis Powers in the U2.
Yeah.
So all that experience was around, okay?
Yeah.
And then Sputnik went up before that,
right?
And it was all really, as long as we beat the Russians, right?
Yeah.
So as long as we beat the Russians at the Olympics,
yeah,
as long as we beat the Russians at the World Championships.
Right.
So this was a big, you might say, factor in getting all those communities of American peoples and other peoples to actually focus on this program.
Yes.
So somehow we've got to now drop the competition side and get that cooperation going.
Exactly right.
Angle,
yeah.
Because
the Cold War was a factor, no question about it.
It was a huge factor.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. I'm
all
sorry?
All our lives were basically painted. Yeah.
It was the fear factor and all that, you know, came to the top. And our kids would come home, you know, from school saying, we trained by getting under the desk today to get ready for the big bomb. So it was a real deal in the U.S. But, you know, on top of after saying all that, I could not believe that our cosmonaut friends and our astronaut friends pulled off the Apollo-Soyuz mission in 1975. In the middle of all this, we went over there and they came over here, and we flew one heck of a successful mission with the Soviets. So, you know, the technical guys, the space guys were talking to each other. The politicians probably were not. But that tells you something about scientific people. They can communicate. Don't make any difference what country you come from. There's communications between those people. And that's what happened, I think, with Apollo-Soyuz. Our guys convinced them that we could do this together, and it came off well. It was a great, successful mission. So
that was a template. Now, what happens is if we go to Mars as cooperative, we've got to go via the moon again.
Well, it depends on the system, I guess,
develop. It seems better to go from the moon
as opposed
to from Earth.
Absolutely. Many of my buddies believe we ought to be back on the moon right now with a base, and getting ready to figure out how we can make it so you're right on track there. I don't have any argument with that. Way in the back.
Hey.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, mate. Thanks for coming down to Melbourne anyway.
Yes, sir.
On the ship for starters. You having a good time?
Oh, yeah. They won't let me drive the ship. That's the only complaint I had.
No, thanks for your presentation. It's great.
Thank you, sir.
Just from a personal point of view, though, when those three guys died in the capsule, that must have been, as you like, your family.
Yeah, you know, we were so naive in those days. We didn't think that ever happened. And that was a wake-up call, man, big-time shock. The crew, you got to understand, the astronauts really didn't have that much of a problem with it, because they had test pilot buddies that died in the cockpit, you know, and that happened to them. So they were comfortable, you might say, with a fatality. The problem was the families. the families really took it hard because they had no idea that their guy, their dad, their husband was going into a dangerous type situation. They thought flying on rockets was, you know, big deal, safe. So it was a shock to the astronaut families more so than it was to Shepard and, you know, and Wally, because they, it was like, well, that's just part of the deal, you know. We're going to lose some. But to us, as I said, it brought NASA to its knees. You know, NASA had been declared perfect. No problems, no mistakes. 16 astronauts had flown, not a scratch. And all of a sudden, you kill three people on the pad. You haven't even flown. It was a shocker. And I thought it was over. Many of my buddies thought the program was going to be shut down. And we, you know, we were preparing, looking for other jobs. But I tell you, guys like Von Braun realized that this could be fixed. And they went in and found the problems with the spacecraft. It was just poorly designed from day one. So fixed that, and Apollo 7 proved that that baby was ready to go. And really, that was all we needed, was that one test flight. But it was a shocking experience. And of course, NASA was not prepared for the press invasion. They closed the gates. They did everything wrong. And here we are, the press guys, you know, trying to communicate with the press. NASA shut us down, wouldn't let us talk to anybody. So for about 3 months, it was NASA, the press just hammered NASA, just hammered them. And they got terrible press because if they had opened the, see, we had done everything openly. We had never had a gate closed for a launch. Everything was open. All of a sudden, they closed the gate. Don't show anything, no pictures. And it was a bad time for us in the press room. Because we had to go back and tell our press friends, you know, we can't talk to you. That was just not acceptable to the press. So they sent the ambulance chasers out, and these guys didn't know anything about the space program, and all they talked about was, we killed three people. So it was an interesting experience for us in the press corps, because it was exactly the wrong thing for NASA to do. We wrote a whole new deal, and guess what? And it was, you know, here's how you handle it in the future. You know what they did? They threw that away, and as soon as Challenger went down, they went through the same damn thing. Locked the gate, stopped talking to the press. They never learned, you know. So when you have an open program like NASA is, a civilian agency, no classified information, you've got to understand the public expects to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly. And we learned our lesson, particularly with Apollo 1.
Prior to the Apollo 1 launch pad disaster, did you ever hear anything from the other astronauts saying that mistakes are going to happen, or we don't like where this is going, someone's going to get killed? I think Chirac called it go fever.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, you know, that generation of astronauts accepted failure and accidents much more so than the later ones came along. The Gemini, Mercury, well, I'd say the 34 astronauts that I mentioned on those flights, those guys were fighter pilots, test pilots. They had lost buddies, you know, and they knew what that was like. They were better prepared for it. I think the families were the ones that were shocked because they thought the guys were moving into a safer business.
Yeah.
You know?
I was just wondering if anyone had told you prior to that, like Chirac apparently didn't like the
Yeah, well, that was Grissom. That was not Wally. Yeah, but yeah, there was some talk about that. Yeah, there was some talk about, but you know, North American Aviation designed the X-15. They should have known how to design the Apollo. So that's why the astronauts were pretty comfortable with North American Aviation, because they had X-15 was some kind of a rocket plane. So I think they were not really prepared for all the flaws and things that showed up afterwards. But, yeah, Grissom was very outspoken. We would not take him in front of the press at times because he was too out. He cussed a lot, used bad words, and that always drove us crazy, you know. But, you know, he was true. He was very accurate. He's very true. You know, he'd tell you the real deal. And so he probably knew more about what was going on there than many of the others did.
Apparently, said that Grissom was actually a bit too afraid to mention all his misgivings about man module. And he apparently told John Young, he said, in the conversation, that why don't you voice up to NASA management? He said, if I do, they'll fire me. Does that sound right?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that that was a closed type environment, because guys like Deke Slate, he would listen, I guarantee, and so would Shepard. See, Shepard and Slayton were grounded at that time, and they were really running the astronaut office. We had to go through them for get anything done, and they were knowledgeable. They knew what was coming along. I think they thought that they needed to do that those testing procedures to really identify the problems. And see, we weren't about to launch. We were still going ground testing. But that plugs in, plugs out test was, everything was buttoned up, you know, and you had 100% oxygen, and we had never had a problem with 100% oxygen. And boy, we had a spark, and that thing, it just like an explosion. And of course, the hatch was terribly designed. No. So, you know, it was a learning experience. But Shepard said this to me. He said, you know, I look at that as a failure, and I lost some friends. But he says, you know what? That probably prevented us from having a failure out there 5 years from now. And I think he's probably right. We got to go.
Wrap it up.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Dick.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.